Welcome and thank you for joining today's conference, What Matters Now, Turning Secular Trends into High Conviction Ideas. All audio lines have been muted. Please type any questions you may have into the Q&A box and press send. Questions will be addressed during the Q&A portion of this call. Today's discussion may contain forward-looking statements. All statements made that are not historical facts are subject to a number of risks and uncertainty. Actual results may differ materially. Please refer to ARS's website for important legal and disclosure information. With that, I'll turn the call over to Sean Lawless.
Thanks, Sarah. Good afternoon, and on behalf of all of my colleagues here at ARS, we'd like to wish you a happy and healthy new year. And I have to tell you, we're looking forward to the prospect of actually getting to meet in person again soon, as soon as it's safe, and hopefully that's in the not too distant future. Before we get started, wanted to take just a couple of minutes, sort of logistics things. As Sarah had mentioned, there's a Q&A box on your screen, which will allow you to type in and submit questions to us. But I also wanted to talk about the format of today's call, which is a little bit different than our past calls. We're actually going to give you a fair amount of information, some pretty good detail on six of the businesses that we own in portfolio. So I think it's going to be very interesting. It's as I said, a fair amount of detail. And that means we're probably going to be spending a little bit more time talking between ourselves. Probably expect 40 to 45 minutes of discussion, which is a little bit longer. But again, I think it's going to provide a nice window into how we're thinking about things and how we're allocating capital. During our last call, Arnold, Stephen, and Andrew highlighted the six critical transformations taking place in the global economy. And today's call is really going to be an extension of that call, where, again, we're going to give you a closer look into the research process and how we translate these trends, these secular trends, into the actual businesses that we own in client portfolios. And we're going to focus on two of the critical transformations today, that being the climate and the digital transformations. But before we get started, just looking back real quickly, 2020 was a challenging year on many fronts. But as a firm, ARS, we did have some wins. And I'll highlight a couple of things. One, we were able to add talent to the team with the hiring of Tom Winnick, Sarah Neer, to augment our business development efforts, as well as Nitin Sacchetti, who joined us on the portfolio management team. In addition to adding talent, our performance was strong across many of our strategies in 2020, including our focused all cap, our focused small cap, and our focused ETF portfolios. And remember, these results are on the back of a very strong 2019 as well, as we continue to add to our long-term track record of building capital and protecting capital for clients. And if you were on the last call, you know we have a constructive investment outlook for 2021 as well, particularly for those businesses that are the primary beneficiaries of the trends that we've been talking about for some time. So today I'm joined by Ross Taylor and Nitin Sacchetti. And I'd like to start the discussion with one of the transformations that is accelerating, that being the climate change. And this creates multiple opportunities, whether it's electric vehicles, battery technology, power management systems, and others. And I'd like to start the discussion here, Ross, and maybe start it by talking about how we're looking at this important transformation.
Certainly, Sean. We'll start by looking at how we're looking at the EV market, because it's one of the most important markets out there right now, and it's the one of the ones that's evolving the most rapidly. In the last couple of years, Elon Musk has almost single-handedly taken the electric vehicle market, or the electric vehicle, from a fringe concept to a rapidly evolving future for almost all motor vehicles. EVs have gone from something that was really of interest only to green energy enthusiasts to what many people feel is the very future of the motor vehicle. Today, every major automobile manufacturer in the world and a lot of other players that didn't even exist a few years ago are developing and even producing electric vehicles or zero emission vehicles or ZEVs. dozens of nations have already put in place ZEV or electric vehicle mandates that will be going into force between 2025 and 2050. And while the US is not one of them, Canada, the UK, France, Germany, Japan, and China are. There is a consortium of 11 US states that have formed a zero emissions pact on passenger vehicles that will go into effect by 2040. And even Rolls-Royce has said that it wants to be 100% electric by 2030. So the rock's been dislodged, and there's not going to be any stopping this avalanche of development. Morgan Stanley estimates that there will be 113 million EVs globally by 2030, and that will grow to over 920 million by 2050. They see all of this requiring a global infrastructure investment of over $11 trillion. And so while Tesla is the highest profile EV company in the world, and certainly the most valuable one, it's far from alone in this space. But even with all this momentum behind the move towards EVs and ZEVs, an investor such as ARS finds this space posing a lot of challenges. How does one value companies that have little or no operating history? How do you value a company that might generate no or only a very small level of sales? How do you value companies that burn prodigious amounts of free cash flow instead of generating it, and where the barriers to entry are often quite small? It's an industry, the EV industry, is one where the most often cited benchmark for value is backlog. And backlog usually represents nothing more than a somewhat advanced indication of interest, evidenced by a small and fully refundable deposit on the basis of an interested customer. Unlike the aerospace industry, for example, where when you order a commercial jet or a business jet, you could be putting down a quarter to a third of the value of the airplane when you place the order, and don't expect to get it back unless there's an extraordinary circumstance. So as an investor, we generally prefer to buy proven companies, companies that have shown they can produce products and make money while doing so. And while we have demonstrated comfort at stepping into more developmental names at times, such as Biohaven or Intrusion, which we've talked about in prior calls, we realize that in a market space where verve and excitement have replaced reasoned investment analysis, the risks can be as great as the rewards. Because we know that history has told us something, that many of the early leaders in the space will fall by the wayside before the industry itself becomes mainstream. So this is an area, as I said, that offers tremendous opportunity, but also can be a little bit of a minefield going forward.
Yeah, right. I'll tell you, it certainly feels like we're at an inflection point for the EV industry. And inflection points typically manifest themselves in a flood of capital investment, and that can lead to choke points. And choke points by themselves can also lead to opportunities. So maybe talk about, you know, some of the dynamics that are taking place and how we're addressing those.
Thank you, Sean. I think you've touched on a very important point, both to the way we invest and how we think that one should look at these opportunities, which is that we expect the rise for electric vehicle to create a number of choke points. And for those who aren't familiar with the phrase, a choke point in this case, in a technological case, is our components or technologies that are needed by most, if not all, players in the space. One of the most evident choke points we found is batteries. But we were troubled when we started to do our research because it's not yet clear what battery technology is going to end up ascendant, if any one does. One expert's going to tell you it's going to be lithium ion. The next will favor nickel metal hydride or some other new and yet to be developed technology. Making it all the harder for us as an investor is that many of these as yet unproven battery companies already have market capitalizations measured in the tens of billions of dollars. So rather than bet on a single battery technology or a single company prevailing, we decided to see if we could find a way to bet on the success of batteries themselves as a general principle, which led us to Mountain Pass. Mountain Pass is the only US producer of NdPr, which is considered the most valuable rare earth element. It's essential to the production of magnets that are themselves essential to the production of batteries and the use of batteries in electric motors, whether they be in electric vehicles, wind turbines, or pretty much any other advanced motion technology or wireless communication technology. Most of the world's NdPr actually comes from China or Africa. And China is about the only place in the world to get this rare earth refined. But our growing trade and geopolitical tensions with China make it strategically unwise and perhaps even strategically reckless for the U.S. to rely on China to provide us with this essential component. As at this time, the only domestic producer of NdPr, and likely soon to be the only domestic refiner of it, Mountain Pass is not only important, our research indicates its success could be considered to be a strategic imperative for the United States. And this is part of why the DOD, Department of Defense, has provided Mountain Pass with financial assistance in bringing its refining capacity online here in the US. Just to give you an idea how big the opportunity in front of Mountain Pass can be, the market for EV motor magnets is expected to grow at a 30%+ compounded annual growth rate for the next 10 years. This means that the demand for electric motor magnets will grow 15-fold over that 10-year period. If EVs hit 75% of global auto production by 2030, the demand for NdPr from EV batteries alone will consume over 100% of the globe's current NdPr production each and every year. And that's before you add in all the other uses that are demanding a share of global NdPr production. Looking at it this way, you see that Mountain Pass has a very attractive outlook for years to come. Now, with regard to valuation, it's important to always remember that great ideas don't always make great stocks. But when we plug the NdPr pricing assumptions from the Rare Earth Industries Association into our valuation model, it yields almost $3 a share in earnings for Mountain Pass in 2023. If you attach a 20 times PE on top of those earnings, which we don't believe to be a heroic PE, it gives us a stock that should trade at $60 a share or more in 2023. That's double the price it's currently trading at today. As the story plays out, we believe a higher multiple would not only be easy to justify, but is likely to turn out to be the case, making Mountain Pass a potentially very lucrative investment for our clients over the next 2 to 4 years, or even longer. I'll toss it back to you, Sean.
Thanks, Ross. Nitin, let's bring you in. Another area that we are focused on is semiconductors, which have broad application across different products and industries. But we found an interesting way to play it within the context of electric vehicles. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, of course. So originally, when we were looking for auto exposure, we were thinking about sort of the infotainment systems and, you know, autonomous vehicles, driver assisted systems. And so we were looking to play that technology or technologification of the auto industry. And we came across NXPI. So NXPI makes semiconductor chips that go into the controllers in the car. They go into the infotainment systems. They make sensors, sort of all for this technology shift that's occurring in the car. But what we found when we did some more work on the business was, you know, also a nice way to play electric vehicles through their battery management system. So, you know, what exactly is a battery management system? It's effectively the skeleton of the sensor software chips that optimize the efficiency of the battery. So, you know, for example, when you're driving over a hill, the battery management system senses that change and it shifts the weight through the vehicle, or when you're braking, it allows for sort of a more steady release of the brake, or, you know, what Ross has referred to before as sort of better energy utilization of the brake based on, you know, taking advantage of the heat generated. So all of this basically ensures sort of a more even voltage in the car, and that increases mileage. And so why is this important? So if we look at Tesla, who, as Ross mentioned, is sort of the leader in the space right now, they get about 5 miles per kilowatt hour. So that means on sort of the base Model 3 battery of 50 kilowatt hours, it generates about a 250 mile range. Since, you know, clearly the EV industry, in order to hit parity with you know, ICE, combustion engine vehicles, they're driving towards 350 to 400 miles in range. that 5 miles per kilowatt hour for Tesla is well above sort of the rest of the industry, which is at about 2 to 4 miles per kilowatt hour. So these sort of other industry players really need a great battery management system to sort of improve that efficiency. And, you know, our checks show that NXPI pretty much has the best battery management system in the industry, and they're gaining share, and the company expects to be in, you know, 1 out of 3 EVs in the next 3 years. So, you know, what does that do to NXP earnings? To Ross's earlier point, you know, we have good businesses and we have good stocks, and how do we marry the two? And so in terms of the battery management system, if you look at the chart on the bottom right, global, you know, auto production, you know, suggested, you know, seasonally adjusted auto rates is about 80 million units. If we assume in the next few years, the share of electric is about 35% of that, and NXPI takes a 33% market share, again, the 1 in 3 they expect to win. You know, with a $300 level in content per vehicle, we think they can generate an extra $5 in earnings per share. And that's, again, incremental earnings that's not modeled by sort of the sell side and consensus into numbers. So we're essentially getting a business here that is participating in this sort of general technology shift into the car. And on $170 stock, they'll do about $14 in earnings in a couple years. And on top of that, we get this additional $5 from the battery management system. So we're talking about, you know, $20 in earnings on $170 stock. So we're buying NXP for less than 10 times forward earnings with 20% earnings growth. And so that compares to a high teens multiple on sort of the S&P 500 and the overall market. So, you know, we think this is another great way to play the electric vehicle trend.
Great. Thanks, Nitin. Ross, we just highlighted two names in MP and NXP that probably aren't household names. Our next name, our listeners are going to know, just maybe not as an electric vehicle player, and that's GM. Maybe you can share our thinking on GM.
Certainly, Sean. In many ways, GM is the poster child for a market segment that's put a premium on flash and a pretty heavy discount to substance. We believe that it offers investors a way to win now on growing demand for new cars and to win later as the market transitions further into electric and zero emission vehicles. If you look at the way auto companies are currently valued, there's a huge divide between those who produce internal combustion engines vehicles and those who produce pure EV or ZEV vehicles. If you base the value of leading companies on 2020 auto production, GM is selling for, coming into the day today, about $9,000 per vehicle. Tesla sells for around $1.2 million per vehicle, and NIO, a company with a heavy orientation towards China, sells at a mere $2 million per vehicle produced in 2020. And Nikola, a company that a lot of people think is a fraud and which has demonstrated that it has neither a working power plant nor a way to build its vehicles, sells at an infinite multiple because in spite of having a market cap of around $7.5 billion, it's never produced a working vehicle. As this chart here shows, the performance between GM, Tesla, and NIO has been very markedly different since the end of 2018. At the end of 2018, GM traded at a slight discount to Tesla, a market capitalization of roughly $47 billion versus a little over $57 billion for Tesla. And at a pretty significant premium to NIO, which was trading at that time at about $6.7 billion in valuation. Nikola didn't really trade at this time, so we didn't include it in the chart. In May of 2019, GM raised $1.15 billion in new capital for its Cruise division from T. Rowe Price, giving the Cruise division a post-money valuation of around $20 billion, which was about 40% of GM's market capitalization. And it put the value of GM's Cruise division at about 1/3 of the market value of Tesla. Today's GM's cap has grown to around $70 billion, which is up a bit under 40% in that time frame. And if the Cruise division is still worth about 40% of GM, that means it's only worth about $28 billion. If all of GM's market cap growth was attributable to Cruise over this time frame, Cruise would have doubled in value since that last financing, but at the same time, Tesla, as you can see from this chart, has gone up almost 17-fold, and NIO has gone up even more. I think that when we're looking at it, to me, one of the things you see here is that there also, it's not on this chart because we've been way too busy. There are a lot of other companies in the EV space and ZEV space that have not inconsequential market caps. They were basically nothing 2 years ago, but they currently have market caps measured in the billions of dollars. These companies have basically, in many ways, seen growth that is comparable to a substantial portion of GM's total market cap growth in the last couple of years. In fact, GM's market cap growth is only equal to about 2.5 times what Nikola is currently valued at. And in fact, not long ago, it would have been dwarfed by Nikola's value, because before too long, but back in late last year, Nikola had actually done a deal with GM. And at the time, Nikola was trading at about 2 times the price it currently is trading at. Now, I'm not trying to disparage the new entrants, and I know that some are going to be very successful. But as I said, history has shown us that many new and established players vying for a piece of rapidly growing pies end up just not making it. And if you don't believe that, just ask yourself, who made your first cell phone? Who made your first PC? And are either of those companies still making cell phones or PCs today? So you can ask yourself, though, why invest in GM as an EV play? Because for us, the newcomers have little or no income. They generate huge levels of negative EBITDA, and they carry market valuations in the billions of dollars, while their success, bluntly, is simply not guaranteed. At the same time, in spite of losing a fair amount of money in its EV business, GM is still going to make $6 a share this year. And it can keep doing this, making $6 plus a share, despite sinking billions of dollars into growing its EV and autonomous vehicle business in coming years. And to fund this multi-billion dollar, tens of billions of dollars of investment that they're going to put into these businesses, they're not going to need to issue new and dilutive shares. They're not going to need to increase the level of leverage on these companies, because their core business spits out billions of dollars of free cash flow each and every year. So the question we asked ourselves when looking at GM was, has GM so botched its EV and autonomous driving effort rollout that its Cruise division has lost value, not only relatively, but absolutely? Tesla and NIO, as I mentioned, have seen their market caps grow in the last 2 years by 1,200%. GM is up something closer to 40. Does it really make sense that GM's Cruise division in the last two or fewer years hasn't grown in value at all over this period? After all, as I said, Nikola, who needs someone to bail them out and provide both a power plant and manufacturing capability, turned to GM to solve these problems. But the market doesn't really get excited about GM. And in fact, most of our listeners' eyes will glaze over if I talk about GM as a leading technology company. But it's important to remember that GM actually holds more EV patents than Tesla, and its autonomous driving system is getting better reviews in the open market than Tesla's. And GM has a single stack 400 volt battery that can charge at 200 watts and a 400 volt battery that can charge at 350 watts, where right now Tesla superchargers are capped at 150 watts. So while Tesla cars have ranges about 250 miles unless you pay up for the extra range, GM's Ultium platform is looking at having a range of 450 miles, which will take the range issue out of the EV. There are two big issues that have plagued EVs in the last few years. One is cost, and the cost has come down to where they're trading in line or costing in line with regular vehicles. And the second is range. People are very reticent to get in a car that they think can't take them as far as they need to go, or it's going to need 2 hours or more to recharge halfway there. But now with the moves GM is making, we're going to see that range issue is no longer going to be an issue. So over the next 5 years, we expect GM to put $27 billion in investment into its Cruise division. And this investment is going to let it launch 20 new EV models by 2023. And 30 new models by 2025. GM also, we believe, has a chance to become what we might call the arsenal of EV production, because GM has a demonstrated ability to mass produce high quality end products and make money doing so. And to us, this means that as more and more vehicles shift to electric, many of those companies that are in the marketplace today that are really little more than concept labs and marketing arms could find themselves turning to GM to provide production capacity and capability, thus allowing them to save limited resources by remaining asset light. And this just allows GM one other way to win in the EV wars that we see going forward.
Thanks, Ross. I'm going to pivot the conversation now towards another transformation that we have high conviction view in, and that's the digital transformation. We've written about it quite a bit, and it's certainly well represented in our portfolios. Nitin, maybe you could kick off the discussion around the continued growth of the cloud and data.
Yeah, of course. So let's just start with the basics and talk about, you know, what is the cloud? It's really just the storage of information and workflows in a data center rather than on your computer at home, your computer in the office, or a server, you know, in your office, which is called on-premise. So why has this transition been happening over the last, you know, 15 years? It's been happening partly because it's so much cheaper to buy servers and buy storage or a large computer system in a data center where you have scale from energy and you have scale purchasing for sort of these large systems versus on-premise, meaning at your home or in your office. And so when you have this ability to buy compute power cheaper, that effectively means you can buy more and more. And so that started this cycle what we call the great data super cycle. And so that started just because, you know, as internet speeds have gotten faster too, that's allowed more data to be called faster from the cloud, from the data center versus keeping it on premise. And a great sort of example in our homes is the difference between, you know, putting a DVD in a DVD player and pressing play versus, you know, going on Netflix and calling up a movie, because that movie is effectively stored in the cloud. And so you're calling that movie over the data infrastructure, your coaxial cable or, you know, your fiber optic cable. And so what do we think? Again, this has been happening for a long time. And so as Ross mentioned, on the EV front, we have to differentiate when we're stock picking between sort of the vaporware businesses and the real businesses. So how are we differentiating between the businesses that make sense and the businesses that, don't? That's really a function of just sort of what's already worked because they've been involved in the early stages of the cloud versus what's involved in sort of this next stage of the cloud. And we're essentially defining and looking at the next stage of the cloud as being driven by AI, artificial intelligence, also known as machine learning or neural networks. So when we think about AI, that connotes sort of the science fiction of a robot talking to us like it's a human and mimicking human emotions. But, you know, AI is as simple as my bread maker, which has, you know, a container for oil, a container for water, and a container for flour. And, you know, when I put a different flour in and it sort of has the history of the last type of flour, it may be, you know, dilutes the dough a little bit too much. And then it learns from that, sees that the dough is too diluted, and then it adds more flour into the mix. And so it's effectively learning and iterating. And so that's sort of a very simplistic example of everything that AI is going to do in terms of sort of changing businesses. And so, you know, Sean's called this the positive data feedback loop before. And so that sort of begins with this compute intensity we talked about that we're buying cheaper in the data center. And that kind of prompts this early stage of AI. And that allows future applications. So, you know, robotics, autonomous vehicles, and those future applications create more data. And that additional data, we can analyze. And then what happens is software engineers analyze that data, and then they create even better algorithms or better software to create even more enhanced and more complicated AI, where the computer can do more and, you know, learn from its errors even better. And so when you're creating all this data and you're sending it all back to the data center or the cloud, you need infrastructure to do that. You need transmission infrastructure. So that's sort of where 5G comes into play. So 5G is effectively continuing to enable this data super cycle because, you know, 5G allows more data to be transmitted back to the data center, and that data gets collected, it gets analyzed in real time, and that allows decisions to be made faster. So, you know, something like this oil well example, where if you have a drill that's drilling drilling into the earth. And that drill can figure out the best direction to drill without going offline, because it's sending all of that data real time back to the data center, to the cloud. And that data is being analyzed by, you know, machine learning AI. It can decide where to go through more efficiently in terms of actually extracting that oil, finding and extracting the oil. So, you know, these are all of the different mechanisms by which, you know, AI will work, and, you know, how that AI feeds more data, which feeds, you know, the need for more transmission, like 5G and fiber optic networks and coaxial cable networks, which then feed sort of more data, better AI, more compute intensity. And then you see sort of this, you know, industrial super cycle, consumer super cycle, as consumers, you know, essentially consume more video. And that video tends to grow, or will grow, with augmented reality, virtual reality, and higher resolution 4K and 8K. And so, again, you sort of see this coming together of the network that transmits the data center, which analyzes it and collects it and computes. And we're seeing workflows in the data center, which have been sort of about a third of all sort of software workflows, are now in the data center. That's moving to 50% in the next, you know, year, year and a half. And so that will continue. So you sort of have all of these large data trends that are then exacerbated by better networks that feed more data, autonomous cars. And then again, that feeds more machine learning, more algorithms, which, you know, feeds the use of more data networks and more compute intensity. So you see how this effect will, you know, essentially compound over time. And we can't forget that, you know, as we have all of this data, as we have all this compute intensity and processing going on and information flowing back and forth, cybersecurity is so important, as we saw from, you know, the breaches a month and a half ago. And so again, it's neural networks and AI, it's increasing video usage, and it's, you know, more workloads all going into the cloud, all creating the super cycle that, again, we also need to protect. So that's sort of how we think about the cloud and how we think about, you know, data growth moving forward.
Great illustration, Nitin. And I have to tell you, I lost track of how many times you said data. But I think what it shows you, it's how critical it is to the feedback loop. And it also highlights the need for memory. We have an investment in a business that is the primary beneficiary of the need for memory. And I know you have some thoughts on Micron.
Yeah. So turning to Micron. So Micron is essentially a manufacturer of DRAM. So that's, you know, dynamic random access memory. So that's basically the short-term memory in your computer, your server, your phone, that allows you to shift quickly between programs. So as we, you know, run more programs simultaneously, again, whether that's more apps on our phone that are more data intensive, or we run more, you know, workflows in the data center, you know, we need more DRAM. And so, essentially building off of what we discussed around AI and machine learning just now, you know, your average server in the cloud, so that's basically effectively a computer in the cloud, in the data center, utilized, as you can see in the top left chart, 9 gigabytes of DRAM in 2008, and that's up to 350 gigabytes per server today. And your average sort of AI optimized server will use 2000 gigabytes. So you see sort of the step function change in the amount of data, DRAM required in a server in the future. And so now when you think of the other side of things, so this Internet of Things that, you know, I somewhat referred to in the last question, in the last point, where you have, you know, the oil drill that effectively is smart, you have the bread maker, you have, you know, more data intensive cell phones, all of those are sort of make up the Internet of Things. And all of those Internet of Things devices, the autonomous car, they all require more DRAM too. So you have increased DRAM usage in the server, along with sort of on-premise in the device itself. So, and the other interesting dynamic in this industry is in 2012, there were about seven players in the DRAM industry. And what's essentially happened is that scale as it relates to capital equipment spending. So that's spending to build more and more DRAM factories or fabrication facilities has cost more money. Some of these fringe players have exited the industry. And so what you've been left with, as you can see in the top right chart, is an oligopoly of three companies, Samsung, Micron, and Hynix. And in that oligopoly, you've essentially seen pricing volatility stabilize. So, you know, the pricing volatility has declined 20%, you know, today versus 2011. So that's created a much more price rational industry. So that's caused more price stability and it's caused better earnings growth. So as you can see in sort of the charts, in the bottom half of the page, you know, you have flat pricing and you have increasing, you know, fabrication facility supply from Micron. And what that's resulting in is about $11 in earnings per share in 2022. And you know, that's growing 15 to 17% a year, 2022 onwards. So you effectively have a stock in Micron that's trading, again, under 10 times earnings, seven times, growing 15 to 20% a year. And, you know, part of this, just one of the integral factors of this big data supercycle. So we really like the business here. And we think, you know, the stock has a long way to go, you know, in terms of appreciation.
Thanks, Nitin. Ross, cybersecurity, you know, simply put, it's a challenge and it's going to require significant capital spend. We've talked about it in the past. You know, if you could just share our latest thinking in the space.
Certainly, Sean. In cybersecurity, anyone who's been with us very long knows we've shown a willingness to step outside of household names to look for successful investments. That included a relatively early investment in Zscaler and last year an early investment in Intrusion. TuFin is an enterprise security software company. We've spoken about in prior calls the fact that cyber attacks are growing, they're becoming more expensive, and they're really just a way of life now for pretty much anyone with a business or any government or agency. The transition to the cloud has made this even more important that we find a solution for cybersecurity. TuFin plays in what we think is a very interesting segment within the cybersecurity area. It manages the many rules that are created inside and through a company's firewall infrastructure. As companies move from a localized cybersecurity infrastructure where they manage each individual office or city or division at that location or in that division to a more centralized approach where they have oftentimes in the cloud managing it through a primary office, this means that companies are having to find ways to integrate the tens of thousands of firewall provisioning rules that currently exist to allow their systems to work and integrate and basically function with each other. This type of work is a very time-consuming task. It involves a commitment of both significant time resources and very expensive and limited manpower resources. TuFin uses an automation and AI approach to centrally house and integrate all the rules, which allows changes to be made and rules to be accessed and provisioned at a very rapid rate. This significantly reduces the complexity of a network and makes it manageable, which might otherwise not be the case. Because companies don't know where the next cyber attack is going to come from or what kind of cyber attack that they're going to end up having, they tend to have a multi-layered defense. They have a lot of different products. And what we've saw in recent cyber attacks is even with all these different products, they don't always necessarily work, which is part of why we last year initiated an investment in a company called Intrusion. But what we find is that with the use of all these different tools, these tools aren't designed to integrate well. They're being made by different companies. They're not necessarily being made to play well with competitors' products and things of that nature. But what TuFin's tools do is they allow the chief cybersecurity officer to set up a single rule that works across all the different vendors and all the different locations. TuFin began pretty aggressively marketing its product in 2018. But a lot of its selling has historically required sitting down with people and showing them what you're doing and talking them through the advantages of the Tufin systems. And this meant that when COVID hit, Tufin's sales force suddenly lacked the ability to do face-to-face selling, which meant it didn't gain a lot of traction with new customers through the second half of last year or the middle part of last year. Therefore, the market quickly dubbed Tufin to be a COVID loser. And it did not participate in the rotation into cybersecurity or software as a service, or called SaaS, stocks in 2020. However, we believe that the funds out there that are earmarked for cybersecurity spending within companies have only increased with the recent attacks, and the focus on getting things right has only grown as a result of those attacks also. And then we see Tufin becoming a large beneficiary of this as its sales force begins to get back into the market and interface with customers directly. And we think this was evidenced by the fact that late last week, they reported substantially better than expected fourth quarter revenue numbers. We believe Tufin can produce $2 to $3 a share in earnings per share in 2024 to 2025. With the stock trading around $17, we feel this is very reasonably priced. As the market realizes Tufin's potential, we think that the company is going to garner a substantially higher multiple. It's not uncommon for SaaS stocks to have 30 times earnings multiples. If we give the stock the potential to get that type of multiple, it could easily become a 3 to 5 bag stock over the next 5 years, a 3 to 5 fold increase in it. Right now, Tufin's generating about $100 million in revenues. And you can see by this chart here, they believe that their annual addressable market is over $10 billion in revenues. Therefore, it became pretty clear to us that we're in the early days of what Tufin is doing and that there's a huge amount of upside available to this company because it is an early leader in a space. And we also think there are two other factors that made us comfortable investing in this company. First is that Tufin has a better than 80% operating margin, which means that it becomes an excellent folding candidate for a larger cybersecurity company. Second is while it has a $500 million market cap, it also has $100 million in cash on the balance sheet and no debt, which basically means that right now, Tufin is selling at about 4 times enterprise value to sales, where it's not uncommon for companies to sell at 20 to 40 times enterprise value to sales. And once again, as I mentioned before, I think this leaves a huge amount of upside valuation opportunity for us as we roll forward and this type of product becomes more of a mainstream product. I'll toss it back to you, Sean.
Thanks, Ross. Circling back to you, Nitin, one of the tasks in that data feedback loop that you were talking about earlier is the transmission of all this data. And you've talked in the past and you've highlighted that the cable companies are uniquely positioned to solve this issue. So maybe if you can elaborate a little bit more on that.
Yeah, of course. So, we think that cable is a really interesting way to play these data trends because it effectively offers the only pipe into the home and into most businesses at a very fast speed. So fiber, yes, it exists in about 5 to 6% of homes passed in the US, but it's too expensive to deploy widely. And, wireless is going to be so busy handling the 5G demand from autonomous vehicles and all of the other applications we laid out earlier that there's no real capacity for it in the home. So basically, this means that cable can continue to increase speeds. So, from 100 megabits per second to 500 megabits to 2 gigabits with very little invested capital, the speeds can effectively be increased to 10 gigabits per second per home for about $50 to $75 in incremental cost for that particular home. So there's very little additional capital that needs to be spent to increase these speeds, but there's significant pricing power that the cable companies have on consumers and enterprises. So on top of that, we talked about this in sort of the 5G call a couple months ago, but you know, when we have these small cells and 5Gs across large cities, that small cell needs to backhaul its data. So, you know, what it means is that when it connects wirelessly to your phone, the small cell on a lamppost, it needs to have a hardwired connection to connect it to the data center or the cloud. So cable has the largest infrastructure of fiber and coaxial cable in the ground, of anyone. And so cables, pipes, they're pipes in the ground, you know, in the pavement, on sidewalks will be accessed, and for the small cell backhaul, and that'll be an additional revenue stream for cable. Now, specifically talking about LILAC, which is one way we think is really interesting to play cable. So this is a cable company in Latin America. They own, cable companies in different regions in Latin America, as it says in this chart. And they also, more interestingly, own the only fiber optic cable connecting the U.S. to Central America, South America, and the Caribbean. So the value of owning this fiber backbone is that it allows LILAC to roll up the market or acquire some, you know, additional small cable companies across Latin America. And because the cost of transmission goes down so much because they, you know, own the pipe themselves, they realize significant cost savings and returns on sort of what they spend to acquire these businesses. So, you know, an illustrative example of the acquisition playbook for LILAC. So, you know, in Costa, they acquired in 2018 Cable Tico, which was a cable company in Costa Rica. So they paid just over $300 million to acquire the business. So that was a multiple on EBITDA, that would be the price paid, the $313 million divided by the EBITDA or earnings before taxes and interest and depreciation generated by the business. So that was about a 5.9 times multiple based on cost cutting, scale purchasing of equipment, cutting out sort of corporate overhead. They were able to bring that multiple down to 4.4 times within a year and a half. And so LILAC, the other value here is that they're very smart. John Malone is very smart when it comes to effective use of debt funding or leverage. So they essentially borrowed to buy the business. So they spent up, they paid up $100 million of that $313 million in purchase price in cash. And so the cash flow that the business generated post sort of the cost savings in the acquisition was about $33 million. So they essentially bought the business at 3 times earnings, or they generated a 33% annual return before a kind of continued growth over time of data based on that acquisition. So, you know, when we layer the organic growth opportunity of all of their cable companies based on this data supercycle we discussed, we get something like 55% organic growth between 2020 and annualized between 2020 and 2024. And, you know, when we layer in the acquisitions that they're going to do in the space, that earnings growth or earnings compounded annual growth rate goes to 76% from 55%. So we're essentially buying LILAC at 3 times 2024 earnings. And what's even more interesting than that is they're currently exploring potentially monetizing part of their fiber optic network because infrastructure businesses in a low interest rate environment are looking to buy stakes in these assets. So, you know, Altice USA sold 49% of its fiber backbone for 15 times EBITDA. Should LILAC be able to do that same transaction and we back that dollar value out of the market cap, the stock is trading at 2.2 times 2024 earnings. So, you know, we think there's a lot of upside here. We get one of the best management teams in the world in Liberty and John Malone. And John Malone has said that he thinks LILAC is the best opportunity to roll up cable that he's seen since, he rolled up U.S. cable in the 70s and 80s. So, good business, great dynamics, very cheap valuation. We think there's multiples and multiples of upside here, just like TUFIN. So hopefully we're ending the presentation with a bang.
Thanks, Nitin. That ends our prepared comments for the call. As I look into the Q&A box, we do have one question out there on LILAC. And that is, Nitin, LILAC issue of corruption in the localities that they serve. Does that have an impact on value estimation? So if you want to maybe address that question.
Yeah. So, you know, it's Lilac is interestingly, they acquired an asset from Telefonica in Costa Rica. And what they've essentially stayed away from the countries with sort of issues with, you know, legal issues around property rights and sort of unstable governments. So they've stayed away from Haiti. They've stayed away from Nicaragua, where they were offered the opportunity to buy businesses. You know, they are in Panama, where there's much better rule of law. Same thing with Costa Rica. They're in Puerto Rico, where the fiscal environment is changing for them. And so they're in a lot of locations where, you know, you don't see too many of those issues. That said, you know, when they're also in Chile. And so when the Chile riots were starting, I did an analysis of basically the revenues and the ARPUs for, so the average revenues in for cable companies in Colombia, where you've sort of had issues with FARC for so many years, versus, and also telecom penetration, versus, you know, something like the protests by students in Chile. And what we actually saw was there was only about, despite all of the issues Colombia has had over so long a period of time, there's only about a 10 to 15% difference in telecom penetration rates and broadband, high-speed broadband penetration rates between Colombia and a country like Chile, where, you know, there's been real rule of law for a very long time. And so what that sort of showed us was that, you know, people want to access the internet. You think about Arab Spring, you think about what is happening in North Korea, where people are trying to smuggle, you know, wireless cards into the country to get access to the internet. So I think the way we look at it is, yes, there are, you know, definitely going to be less instability. There's a higher discount rate in some of these countries than the US. So we put a lower multiple on it because of that. But, you know, consumers want internet and broadband penetration will grow. These companies own the pipe and they're not in any countries where there's any real risk of nationalization of the assets. So that's, I think, how we look at that emerging market risk here.
Thanks, Nitin. We have another question in the mailbox, and that is, you know, what are the firm's thoughts on fintech going forward?
Well, I think that we find fintech to be a very attractive area. We have a number of investments that are directly or indirectly related to it. The biggest issue in fintech is the valuations of the companies are presupposing a tremendous amount of success in many cases, and we've done stuff. If you look at something like a PayPal, which has pushed itself well beyond just a payment mechanism and is moving forward in a lot of interesting areas in fintech, and others, you know, trying to make acquisitions and the like, you're paying a lot of money for what you're getting right now. And so we haven't put additional capital into the space recently because of the concerns that the valuations are presupposing high levels of success. But if we were to see pullbacks in them, I think you'd see us perhaps become more aggressive in putting capital to work in the area.
Yeah. Well, listen, we've been at it for almost an hour here. And I know we certainly put out a lot of information. And we're always available to answer further questions. But in the interest of people's times, I think we'll wrap it up here. And I want to thank everybody that called in. And on behalf of Ross Nitin and all of my colleagues at ARS, I want to thank our clients for their support over the years and entrusting us and being stewards of their capital. It really is a privilege and really a pleasure working with each and one of you. So listen, a happy, healthy, and a prosperous new year, and we look forward to seeing you soon. And in the meantime, stay safe. Have a good day, everyone.